From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, sanctions against Russia would hit the US like a boomerang. The warning from Moscow as international pressure builds on Russia to withdraw from Ukraine.
They have not only brought the date forward, they have also upgraded the idea of the referendum, which was originally only for more autonomy. It is now to leave Ukraine altogether and join Russia.
Also today, as US job numbers rise against the odds, we look at the current shape of the US economy. We're at the UN headquarters ahead of International Women's Day, and we find out why Mount Everest is gaining a rubbish reputation.
Old tents or camp cots or things like that, down to human waste and kind of everything in between.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. A special delegation from Crimea is in Moscow to hold talks with the Russian government just a day after announcing a referendum on the region's future. The Russian State Duma speaker says Russia will respect any choice made by Crimean citizens in their vote, which the West and Ukraine say is illegitimate. From Moscow, Dan Whitehead reports.
Crimea's parliament speaker, Volodymyr Konstantinov, is leading the delegation in Moscow. Russian state media reports Mr. Konstantinov insists the referendum will go ahead and the situation will be clarified for Crimean citizens. On Ukraine's new government, he said, "It is illegitimate. We are scared of it." Russia's State Duma Speaker Sergei Naryshkin said Russia will support the democratic choice of the people of Crimea. But these messages come amid confusion over the legality of the vote and condemnation from the West.
Earlier, Russia's President Vladimir Putin spoke directly with his U.S. counterpart Barack Obama, saying U.S.-Russia relations should not suffer due to ongoing disagreements over Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry visited Jordan on Friday for talks with King Abdullah II on the future of the Middle East peace process. America's top diplomat made the unscheduled 3-hour stop on the back of a conference in Rome on Libya, where he also held meetings on the crisis in Ukraine. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The previously unannounced talks with King Abdullah of Jordan and his foreign minister Nasser Judeh are aimed at nudging the Middle East peace process forward. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is hoping to get an agreement by late April between Israel and the Palestinians on a framework for a peace deal, but has signaled that could take another 9 months. U.S. officials have been very quiet on what might go into the agreement, despite U.S. hopes of establishing negotiating positions in order to move forward. Israel has put the burden on the Palestinians to recognize a Jewish state, which they have long refused to do. And the Palestinians say Israeli settlement construction in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem is the main obstacle to peace.
The American economy gained more jobs than expected last month, but the overall unemployment rate is up slightly. The latest figures show the U.S. workforce grew by 175,000 in February, while the jobless rate crept up to 6.7%. Malcolm Brown reports.
The addition of 175,000 jobs is substantially better than the 150,000 anticipated by economists. Predictions were made harder by the severe winter weather that has affected economic activity across large swathes of the country. Meanwhile, the slight rise in the overall unemployment rate is being attributed to the return of job seekers who had given up looking for work.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A Congolese warlord has been convicted of being complicit in crimes including murder and pillage. For his part in an attack on a village in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2003, Germain Katanga supplied weapons to militia who killed over 200 people in the gold and diamond-rich Ituri province. Our Europe correspondent Jack Perak has more.
The International Criminal Court at The Hague in the Netherlands handed out only its second ever conviction in the 11 years since it was set up to militia leader Germain Katanga of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The court found him guilty of 4 counts of war crimes and 1 crime against humanity, being an accessory to the massacre of more than 200 civilians when militia groups under his control attacked the Congolese village of Bogoro. 35-year-old Katanga was, however, acquitted of the charges of using child soldiers, rape and sexual slavery in a trial which has lasted over 5 years.
And Venezuela has expelled the ambassador of Panama and three other Panamanian diplomats as anti-government protests continue around the country. The news comes the day after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro officially ended all diplomatic and economic ties with Panama. FSN Español correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
President Nicolas Maduro has accused Panama's government of conspiring against his administration. This allegation comes after Panama requested a meeting at the Washington-based Organization of American States to discuss the rising tensions and protests in Venezuela. As a result, Caracas declared Panama's ambassador to Venezuela and three other diplomats persona non grata and gave them 48 hours to leave the country. Panamanian government has expressed surprise at Venezuela's decision and said that President Maduro's accusations were unacceptable.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Sanctions against Russia would hit the US like a boomerang. The warning Secretary of State John Kerry received from his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov when the two men spoke on Friday over the ongoing Ukrainian unrest. This followed Moscow's decision to back plans for a referendum on Crimea breaking from Ukraine and joining the Russian Federation. This just a day after President Obama condemned the vote as a breach of international law, with the US and EU ordering punitive measures against Russia, with the threat of tougher sanctions if pro-Russian forces were not withdrawn from Ukraine's southern peninsula. For the latest on the crisis, I spoke to FSN's correspondent in Crimea, Tom Barton.
If you go back to the start of this crisis, it all started with a crisis meeting inside the regional parliament here in Simferopol in Crimea, when a new government was chosen. And it was a very late, a very sort of intense vote that was held. Some of those involved were thrown out of the parliament, some of those that opposed it, and essentially pro-Russian forces basically rammed through their changes to make this a very pro-Russian parliament. And there are others now, other deputies, that have not returned. That was the beginning of the problems. The government in Kiev, the new government, does not accept the legitimacy of this prime minister, or this government and the leaders of it, and then we get to the idea of the referendum, which had already been on the table. It's an idea that's been floated for decades, but they originally wanted a referendum, which they've brought forward now twice, and in this latest idea they have not only brought the date forward, they have also upgraded the idea of the referendum, which was originally only for more autonomy. It is now to leave Ukraine altogether and join Russia. And that is where we may see some more head-scratching and more heart-searching among Crimeans. Do they really want to go this far to leave Ukraine? And on the streets, there are various different parties. There are pro-Russians who basically feel ethnically close to Russia. They feel threatened by what they see as fascist forces in Kiev. There are Crimean Tatars, about 12% of the population, who have a long and dark history in the Soviet Union. They are not happy with that. They're pro-Kiev. And also ethnic Ukrainians who crop up as well in these street debates as well. They're pro-Kiev as well. But when it comes to leaving Ukraine, a lot of even the pro-Russians, a lot of the ethnic Russians, don't want to go so far as leaving Crimea. They only want maybe some more autonomy in the region. They want increased status of Russian language, for example, in the state. They don't want to go the huge leap to jump to Russia. Some do. Perhaps those are older. It's a sort of Soviet mentality that it's perhaps a longing for the Soviet Union and to be part of that and part of Russia again. As it were. But it's not so simple as to say that all of the ethnic Russians here want to join Russia. And there is the chance that having upgraded this referendum, this new parliament, which Kiev does not respect the legitimacy of, or of this vote, although Moscow does, there is the chance that they will lose this referendum.
No doubt you'll be following that vote very closely come March the 16th, Tom. But can you explain to us a bit about the pro-Russian force? Thousands strong. They've been in the region since the focus shifted from pro-revolution Kiev down to Crimea. But can you explain to us how they have been asserting their authority and what their manoeuvres have been in terms of controlling the region?
It seems almost unfeasible that this referendum would not be held under the barrels of thousands of pro-Russian, if not Russian, guns, because there are thousands of troops around here, and evidence has leaked out that they are in fact Russian troops. They speak Russian. There's badges identifying them as Russian. The Kremlin's attempts to deny that they are Russian troops have met only with derision internationally. And I was in the west of Crimea just recently, where Russian naval forces have sunk, have scuppered one of their own anti-submarine ships in the entrance to a bay there that has Ukrainian naval forces in it. There are now reports that they've done that to a second ship as well, blocking that bay and trapping those Ukrainian ships inside. Perhaps as a show of strength, perhaps as part of a tactic to try and make them surrender. There is also a large and very forbidding Russian missile cruiser stood off the coast there as well, as an extra show of force. And as we arrived, Russian troops had started to surround a Ukrainian refueling base there as well. When we talked to the Ukrainian commander, though, like many others across the peninsula, he was not going to be swayed. He said, "We're Ukraine. We will vote for Ukraine in a referendum. We swore an oath of allegiance to Ukraine. And all of these soldiers, these mysterious green soldiers in green uniforms around our territory, are an illegal presence, and that is why our guards on the gates are carrying guns, and we will not be surrendering." So this standoff has solidified somewhat, it seems, in various points around Crimea.
FSN's correspondent in Crimea, Tom Barton. And as those tensions continue between Russia and Ukraine, the Russian ruble and Russian stocks have been hit hard. And the UK is one of the top countries of choice for wealthy Russians when it comes to parking and spending their money. As Russians look to preserve the value of their wealth, more of that money could be seen making its way to London. Combine that with the UK's energy reliance on Russia, and the potential ramifications for Britain are substantial if London takes a tough approach to Russia's intervention in Ukraine. UK correspondent Natalie Feary reports from the British capital.
Russians were the biggest overseas buyers of multi-million pound homes in 2013. They shop at designer stores, keep millions in British banks, and have even invested in British football clubs. Russia's richest man, Alisher Usmanov, is now a major shareholder in Premiership team Arsenal. And with the Russian ruble under major pressure against the pound since the start of the year, more of that money could be heading here, says Jeremy Cook, chief economist at foreign exchange company World First.
Russian money flows out of Russia on a daily basis into places like London. If we see, you know, fire exchanged, if we see a conflict in Ukraine, that outflow is only going to increase.
But Andy Hunder, the director of the Ukraine Institute in London, hopes the prospect of this does not deter the UK from taking a tough stance over Russia's involvement in Ukraine.
There's more Russian money in London than there is in Washington or New York. The United Kingdom now is really on the spotlight. It's, you know, what does it do? Does it focus on the money, or does it focus on democracy in Europe, where an independent state has been invaded?
The UK has appeared more cautious than the United States about the prospect of imposing tough sanctions on Russia. But it also has a lot more at stake, particularly when it comes to oil and gas prices, if Russia were to retaliate by cutting off supplies to Europe, the effects of which could be very damaging, according to World First's Jeremy Cook.
If we see those energy prices increase, there's less money to go around. We're going to see retail sales start to fall off. We're going to see consumer confidence start to fall off. Business output falls off. Business profitability falls off.
Among the businesses that stand to lose the most if relations between London and Moscow do sour are London's luxury hotels and shops. Russians are among the top five highest spending visitors to the UK, so the economic impact of a fall in those numbers will certainly be felt. Natalie Feary, London.
The US job numbers in February rose more than expected, despite concerns that the wintry weather would dampen the picture. Employment increased by 175,000 jobs. But that's still below the strong growth we saw at the end of last year. Earlier, I spoke to FSN's Daniel Renches and started by asking him if the numbers were as encouraging as they appeared.
175,000 is not that bad. And as you know, I'm fond of the three-month average. That was 129,000. So the overall picture here has been pretty dismal in terms of the recovery. But when you look at 175,000 in that context, it shows probably that the winter weather was responsible for quite a lot of what happened in December and January. And the fact that it was pretty cold in February, and yet these numbers have come up much better than expected, is on balance pretty encouraging for the US economy. It's almost, think of it as a bit of a coiled spring. The coil is still under pressure, but still there's some spring in there that can still come out. And I think that's what most economists are now thinking. Pretty encouraging numbers, not the best that we've seen, but certainly pretty good for February.
And a different kind of spring. The economists are predicting that come spring, perhaps these numbers are going to improve. Let's get this bad weather out of the way. People will start hiring again and there'll be more business. People will be able to get into these businesses and spend some money. But Daniel, can I just ask, which sectors in particular in this last month have been hiring people, have been taking on staff?
Well, when you look at these jobs numbers, it's encouraging that a lot of them are high-paid jobs or, you know, medium-income jobs, which helps to create the good momentum in the US economy, because then it creates lots of other jobs on top of that for those who are spending more money. So professional and businesses services is the biggest category. And within that, it's accountancy and bookkeeping that has done particularly well. 16,000 jobs created there. Restaurants and bars, 21,000. That's pretty good as well. But also, if you look at the quality of wages, non-supervised workers, wages up 2.5% over a three-month average from a year ago. That's very good. It means that people who have valuable jobs are being paid for it. So there are some good things. There are some bad things there as well, Kevin. For example, the fact that people like Radio Shack and Staples are just ditching their stores in huge numbers. Radio Shack, 1,100 stores potentially going. Staples, 225. Those are the areas that are suffering. But if you look at Lowe's and Home Depot, they are thinking about hiring up lots and lots of seasonal workers in the coming months. And I think the housing market, if that starts to pick up, that is going to be the good story for 2014.
And Daniel, the central bank, the Federal Reserve pay pretty close attention to these numbers. Will it impact their current plans on tapering back the stimulus?
I think you have to look at what the New York Fed head, William Dudley, has been saying. He's been expressing some optimism, just as we have, about the state of the US economy. And he said that there'd have to be a very high threshold for them not to continue the pattern that they've had. That pattern being reducing the amount of this extreme quantitative easing, which is the buying of assets, mortgage-backed securities and treasuries to stimulate the economy. They are going to continue to taper that down $10 billion each month. The thing to watch, though, Kevin, is this whole threshold about 6.5% unemployment. The unemployment number today went up a little bit to 6.7% because more people are thinking about coming back into the workforce. But it's still about 6.5%, which was the threshold to increase interest rates. I think the Fed's now going to have to signal that that's not what it's going to start to do at this time. It's going to look at some broader unemployment numbers because I don't think the economy is sufficiently strong enough to take a rise in the actual interest rate. And that is something I think the markets are aware of, but the Fed has certainly got to make clear.
FSN's Daniel Renches. Now, this Saturday, women in countries around the world will be celebrating International Women's Day. It's a chance to campaign for women's rights, but more importantly, to seek greater gender equality in both developed and developing countries. The United Nations organisation UN Women is leading the celebrations. Our UN correspondent Nick Harper sat down with the executive director of UN Women, the former South African deputy president Phumzile Mlambo-Nuka. And he started off by asking her about the significance of the day.
International Women's Day is important because it is a day when we celebrate the progress that women have made. And we've come a long way, but we have not arrived where we are trying to go to. So in one way, we celebrate progress, but on the other hand, we recommit ourselves, we rededicate, we expose what is still outstanding so that we can mobilize more people to work with us.
This year's theme is equality for women is progress for all. What does that mean for you?
It means for me that we are changing the emphasis and the narrative. We are showing that there is a cost for humanity in not liberating and supporting women's emancipation, women's empowerment, and gender equity. All of humanity suffers because if, for instance, more girls were to finish secondary school, we would bring down significantly infant mortality. If more girls were to finish school and not be married earlier on in life as girls, we would have more girls who do not fall into poverty and give birth to children that who themselves will create the next generation of poor people.
I wanted to know, did you think that there were any particular countries in Africa that are getting very positive results at the moment in terms of rights for women?
Well, the country that comes to mind immediately is Rwanda. One considers that that country, with everything it has gone through in the world, it is the country that has got the highest number of women parliamentarians exceeding 60%.
Do you think there are any particular countries who perhaps need to do more or need more help to achieve better results?
Well, the fact that most of the least developed countries are in Africa to begin with says it all. And of course, because countries' economies were affected by the economic downturn, because some of the countries have been affected by a conflict and therefore peace and security was compromised, those countries need greater support because in those situations, women suffer more. Women don't engage in wars. Women are not part of the armed conflicts. They are just victims.
For the Millennium Development Goals, quite a few of them dealt with issues to do with women. But of course, we're getting close to the MDG 2015 deadline now. Going beyond that, how important do you think it is to continue the work of women's rights?
There is no doubt in my mind that we've got significant unfinished business. Therefore, post-2015 has got to be about continuing what has not been achieved. We also have to deal with some of the challenges that are creating the biggest barrier to women's progress, starting with violence against women, which is very high.
Of course, you were the Deputy President of South Africa. At that time, you were the highest ranking woman in South African history. Do you think that South Africa could have a female president at any point in the future?
Why not? Why not? I think the people of South Africa are ready for that. I think the women of South Africa are very competent. So, yes, I could see that happening in South Africa.
Executive Director of UN Women, the former South African Deputy President, Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka. And finally tonight, Everest, the world's highest peak, continues to attract a growing number of adventurers and tourists each year. However, that popularity has a price. And when it comes to waste management, the Nepalese government has a mountain of its own to climb. Authorities there have now introduced new measures to clear up the mounting mess left in the wake of expeditions. To discuss the situation, I spoke with mountaineer and editor with Outside Magazine, Neil Heil, and began by asking him just how untidy Everest has become.
You know, I think right now the trash problem is not as bad as the popular perception may have it. It's actually been getting better over the last few years. There have been some particular expeditions devoted specifically to bringing trash down off the mountain. But, you know, it's still an issue up there. It's, as most people know, Everest has become quite popular, both as a trekking destination and as a climbing destination. And every spring, there's this small village that materializes, and you know, as many as 1,000 people are up there, and obviously they can leave behind an awful lot of waste. So there's a real concerted effort now to clean the place up.
Before we talk about a law that's been introduced to try and tackle that problem, can you explain the sort of detritus and rubbish that is left in the wake of tourists and mountaineers alike?
Sure. Yeah, you can imagine. I mean, a base camp village of 1,000 people would produce trash of kind of every nature, anything from, sort of infrastructure that's left behind, like old tents or camp cots or things like that, down to human waste and kind of everything in between, from, you know, little pieces of litter to oxygen bottles up higher on the mountain and that kind of thing. So,
And this waste, this has been culminating for years and decades even.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the mountain's been getting climbed now for, 60-some years, and it's only getting more and more popular and more crowded. So the trash was accumulating for a while, and now I think there's a real effort to kind of bring the amount of trash up there down. So,
in one article I saw, when they talked about the nature of the rubbish that's strewn across this region, they also talked about the fact that even the bodies of climbers are an issue.
It is an issue. You know, I don't know how many bodies are still up there and in plain sight, but, you know, it's extremely difficult to get a body down off the upper mountain. So when somebody does die up there, it's nearly impossible from the upper reaches of the mountain to get them back off. So they do end up sort of getting frozen into the side of the mountain, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. If it's a little further down and they can get a team up to them, it's easier to get those corpses removed. But the ones up high, they tend to stay there.
So the Nepalese government has introduced a new law in order to combat the litter and waste left behind by tourists to the area. Can you give us some details on that?
Yeah, well, so they recently announced that they were going to require every climber who's up there to pack out 18 pounds of garbage each. This would exclude their used oxygen bottles and also human waste. So the thinking really is that because they've calculated that climbers leave on average about 18 pounds of trash, or create about 18 pounds of trash, this is a kind of pack it in, pack it out rule. And what they're trying to do is not necessarily have these climbers remove the trash that's up there, but not add any new trash on top of what's already there. And the way they're doing this is they're requiring expeditions to leave a deposit as much as $4,000, and they don't get that deposit back unless they can weigh out at the end of the expedition and show that they've packed out the stuff that they've brought up the mountain.
Nick Heil, mountaineer and editor with Outside Magazine. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can contact us by email about the show, reports@featurestory.com. And you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. On Monday's programme, we'll have a report on Edward Snowden's long-distance participation in the South by Southwest conference in Austin. And we'll have an interview about the latest events in Ukraine with former Assistant Secretary of State David Kramer, now head of Freedom House. That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.